everyone, and welcome to Main Street Universe. I'm Daniel Michael, still awaiting Kevin Baird, but we're going to start off with our song. Welcome to Main Street Universe. Our co-host Kevin Baird has just arrived. That was our opening song. And
good morning, good morning.
From his long journey all the way from the Temple of Gaia. Mr. Kevin Baird is a psychic medium intuitive consultant. You can find him at www.templeofgaia.com or at the stores Crystalis in Herndon or Sticks and Stones in Fairfax, Virginia. And today we will be discussing with our guest, author and social activist, once a talk show host for about 12 years, I believe, on WCBM in Baltimore, nationally syndicated, and it is Dr. Zohara Hieronymus. And we will be discussing her new book, Sanctuary of the Divine presence. And I believe I saw her number in the queue. And if she's there, I would like to welcome Dr. Zahara Hieronymus. Are you there?
I am here. Good morning, Daniel, and to everybody else. Temple of Gaia, what a great name.
Yes, the Temple of Gaia, that's Kevin's thing.
Thank you.
She liked the name. And first of all, I'd like to say, Zoe, it's nice to hear your voice again.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. You know, if people may not know, but when I was a daily broadcaster at a CBS affiliate in Baltimore, I was a whistleblower. But on occasion, I did really fun things. And one of them was a talent show I would do each year. And that's how Daniel and I met. He came and was a wonderful singer-songwriter contestant. So we
that's
go
right.
we go back now, I guess, 10 years.
Yeah.
Maybe more.
Gosh,
20, I guess, actually.
It's been a while, and it's amazing how many long changes have happened since probably the last time I've talked to you.
Yeah, well, you know, for your listening audience, I was a whistleblower on regular AM radio for 10 years, and it was actually the longest aired whistleblower program in broadcast history on the AM dial. And that's when Daniel knew me. So I covered the unfortunate realities of the end of the latter Bush administration and then the Clinton administration all years and the first year of the second Bush administration. And at that point, I really had a broken heart from covering all of the sort of nasties that humans do to each other, to animals, to the environment, that I had a really life-changing call to God. You know, one could call it a divine revelation, or I think anybody who ever goes on a spiritual quest knows what it means to have a calling. And your other host and other people in the audience and yourself, Daniel, know what that is. And what I found was, actually, for 88 days after I left my radio program, it was the first time in my year in my life I wasn't sure what I was going to do. And so for me, that was pretty peculiar, having always been task-focused. And every time I closed my eyes for 88 days, I was like in this massive sea of waves all by myself, and only years later did I find out that it's a state of consciousness in Kabbalah that they call the Seas of Noach, which is actually a state of isolation that brings a person to some sort of awareness. And when it stopped on the 88th day, I understood that I had to go back to something I'd studied on and off since I was 14, which was Kabbalah, the received tradition of Judaism. And so my second book, the one we're going to talk about today a little bit, Sanctuary of the Divine Presence, is a result of that 10-year immersion that I've just completed in looking for the mystery tradition or the wisdom teachings within Judaism that were hidden in a way that so many Jewish people like myself in the 60s and 70s and even today, you know, become Buddhist or Amerindians or turn to Hinduism or Shintoism or some other faith other than their own. And I decided to really find out what was the sacred wisdom tradition within Judaism besides just the literal reading or the normative interpretations of the Hebrew Bible. And so what this book is, to just sort of summarize it very quickly, is a system of correspondences that I was shown in a single revelation in my sukkah, the holiday commemorating the Exodus from Egypt and the divine cloud of glory and the pillar of fire and the tabernacle itself that the Israelites erected and took down and erected and took down all during those 39 of the 40 years. And what I was shown is that this tabernacle that Moses was told by God to build and which all of the Israelites, all of the ancient Hebrews contributed to themselves, is actually a model of each human being. And it's a model of how every human and the stages we go through are represented by the rituals of the tabernacle tradition. And that if we understand them, each one of us becomes the high priest in the Holy of Holies by the Ark of the Tabernacle with the cherubim who are sort of like conducting this holy fire of God's presence. And each of us enters a state of divine revelation. So my book is a series of correspondence systems.
Okay, and that kind of leads me into what was going to be one of my first questions about Kabbalah itself, and that being how it was passed down and how it was said to be passed down. And what I had read, and of course you're much more of an expert on this than me, it was from God to angels, angels to Adam, Adam to Noah or Enoch, perhaps, Abraham, the Egyptians, to Moses, then the four books of Torah reaching King Solomon. who then they say mastered the Kabbalah, which takes us to some funny connections when you're talking about spiritual traditions, because my first experience running into Kabbalah was not in looking up Jewish mysticism, but was just looking up mysticism, magic, or even witchcraft itself, and then just, and there'd sometimes be in some of these books a little section on Kabbalah mentioning it.
Well, you know, the Tree of Life, which is the model that all of Kabbalah is about, and Kabbalah means received tradition, because for centuries it was an oral tradition passed down from teacher to student. You couldn't buy an entry. You know, you had to sort of earn your own vibrational wellness to be a student of some of the masters, to be accepted into the schools, and then to be taught these teachings. Because the teachings ultimately would show any one of us, if we're able to do it, how to commune with the reflexive universe. You know, when you look at King Solomon, who was King David's son, King Solomon represents in the Tree of Life, there are these 10 sephirot, or balls of luminous energy, which are actually a model of our own body. So it showed up in alchemy and in Wiccan tradition and in many traditions, because the Tree of Life is actually a model of the human being through the lens of the Hebrew tradition and the Hebrew language. But it makes it possible then, when anybody studies this Tree of Life, which is actually the human body, the head, the torso, the two arms, the two legs, the generative organs, the feet, the eyes, the ears, etc., you are able then, like these other pagan traditions, to come into communion with nature. So in the same way a dowser comes into this beta state through his practice and might be able to move a water vein, it is by collaboration with the water elementals. It's not just his own mind. So I think the beauty of this book, The Sanctuary of the Divine Presence, that was published in 2012, just a few weeks ago actually, is that it shows us how each one of us is a high priest, how each one of us does perform the fire rituals of burning off our ego. That was the bull sacrifices, or the dove, or the others, and we do purify our emotions like the priest does when they purify their hands and feet before going into the holies, where they light the sacred incense and they light the menorah and they eat the shewbread, and those all represent actually the faculties of our senses, which are the vehicles of the soul. So on and on, all of it is a progressive description of the stages each one of us go through in our spiritual development.
Okay. And that's very interesting, and there's definitely an aspect of what you just brushed upon that I wanted to get to. And I believe it's in the Zohar, which I'm guessing, does your name come from that?
Yes, my name does, and it was given to me by a gentleman I studied mime with at the age of 19, who was a Moroccan Kabbalist, Samuel Avital, and he remained my teacher for many, many years until very recently, when I sort of, you know, at some point every student says goodbye to their teacher and hello as a friend. And so,
oh, yeah.
After 40-some years, but he was wonderful, because he's from the Sephardi tradition of Morocco, and my other teacher is from the Ashkenazi, the European tradition of Russia and Poland. So I was really beautifully schooled by the two different main streams of esoteric teachings.
And it's great to have good teachers. And Zohar, if I'm correct, means splendor and radiance.
Yeah, and splendor of light. So when I didn't have a Hebrew name, though I'm Jewish, and most Jewish parents give their children a Hebrew name even if they don't use it, but my parents didn't give me one. So when he gave me my Hebrew name, it felt like somebody finally understood my soul, because our names are supposed to be vehicles for our soul. And an interesting thing about that, you know, many of us in the spiritual traditions have changed our names. But in Judaism, even if you add a new name, like adding a new vessel for the light to fill, which they often will do when somebody's deathly ill, they'll add a new name to that person so that there's a new vehicle for the divine force to animate, but we don't lose a name. So if you look at my books, it's J. Zohara Meyer Hieronymus. The J is for Jill, my birthday. It's a really long name, but they say, don't ever give up a part of yourself. So it might be Sally, Starbird, Nathaniel, Heehawk or something, you know.
Yeah. And another aspect of what you mentioned before I'd like to get to was the idea of our participation. One thing I remember from reading about Kabbalah is the idea, and perhaps you can expand on this, of course, the idea of not God casting out Adam, but Adam casting God away from him.
Well, it was a very deliberate choice. I mean, if you think about the recording in the Hebrew Bible of the description of Adam and Eve, you know, taking from the tree that they were told not to, and when God finds out, because presumably, like the Akashic record, all is already known, and this superconscious voice comes into the garden, and Adam and Eve hide, and what do? Adam blames his wife, and Eve blames the snake, and neither of them originally took responsibility for their own free will choice. So it was really the beginning of watching the exercise of free will, and it represents what any of us do, is we don't really get thrown out of spiritual dominions. We outcast ourselves by a shift in our vibration. You know, the spiritual hierarchies and the spiritual kingdoms, whether they're angels or ascended masters or spiritual guides or our deceased loved ones, only want to see us succeed. So they're not going to throw us out of anything. What Adam did was he didn't take responsibility for his own free will, and because of it, you know, there was this thing which each human being has to go through. I mean, it was deliberate. We could say if the Creator is all consciousness, then consciousness must have known that Adam was going to choose to do these things and despoil perfection. And why? From the Kabbalistic tradition, it said it was to enable every human being to have the opportunity to achieve self-mastery on their own. Had Adam or Eve not done anything of their free will that in any way violated the perfection that existed in that vibrational moment of creation, none of us would have the opportunity to really evolve as individuals on our own free will. And that's what's so vital about incarnating in a human body, is our soul, which is always present while we're alive in our physical body and always eternal outside the physical body, is here helping us make these fine decisions, just like an Adam and Eve or any other personage in the Hebrew Bible. You know, these are choices we make. So the story itself in the Hebrew Bible is really a story about every human being and the journey and paths that we go through. And another book I wrote on the seven prophetesses of ancient Israel, I showed how each prophetess, when they were born, took the Israelites into a new state of awareness. And so when the Jewish people read the Torah each week, on Sabbath we read a certain portion called a parsha of the Torah, and it's the same portion in the same Hebrew that it was written in thousands of years ago that every synagogue is reciting. We don't have a bunch of different texts. We might have some different interpretations, but the source material has remained the same since it was ever first written down. And so you can go anywhere in the world into a synagogue on Sabbath, and the congregation will be studying the same thing that another congregation is studying halfway around the world. And the beauty in that, we know from quantum physics, is that it's creating a sort of amplitude of waveform that facilitates the conscious awareness that links us not only to those historical moments, but to the purpose and meaning of them within our present life today.
Yes, and what I really like about what you're saying is the activity and the oneness of it. And it, again, as we mentioned earlier, it has certain things in common. Even the creation story does have some elements in common as to why we're here and what we're doing with these other mystical traditions. I'm a member of a pagan tradition myself. Mm-hmm. And the idea is we descended into this physical low-vibrating form, but then have this choice to make this reascension. So there's these great
exactly.
similarities. And I wanted to mention something about that, about putting yourself on the right path. And this is something that some people might think is a little controversial because it has the word fear. And I remember reading one passage of fear of God and rejoicing in fear. But I was interpreting this as not like fear, like being afraid of things, but fear as in sort of accepting or embracing humility, and that a certain degree of humbleness and thankfulness is necessary for ascension.
Absolutely. I mean, that's really the cornerstone of prophecy. We learn this in every sacred society, that humility, you know, makes us that empty vessel that then spirit can fill. And if we aren't humble, then those pure vibrations, whatever they are, looking for vehicles of consciousness to fill, aren't available. So I think all of the work, I've studied many of the Western mystery traditions and some of the Eastern, and like many of your audience, have been very involved in the spiritual journey since I was 3, when I had my first out-of-body experience and near-death experience. But since then, you know, all of these interdimensional realities have been of interest to me. And I think in my many years of interviewing great quantum physicists, what I have come to appreciate is that the modern quantum physicist is basically giving us the language to articulate the mystery tradition actual process. So when I began today, I said, you know, the universe is a reflexive universe, and quantum physics shows us this. And the mystery traditions and the sacred holy societies have always said this. You know, watch what you think, because what you think has power, meaning it's not just a nothing something. It's a real substance that is impinging in the immaterial domain, and when we become conscious of something over time, an example, let's say some part of the world is under great duress from an environmental tragedy, an earthquake, and we're not experiencing it here, Daniel, or Kevin, or anybody else listening, but they are halfway around the world. Well, if all of us in that moment pray for those people in that part of the world and pray for divine right order, it has a literal, actual impact on the outcome of that situation. Now, we may not be able to measure in what way, but we know from the thousands of experiments that have been done on prayer that when we surrender our will and our ego and our concept of what that would look like to say, may divine right order be restored, the highest amplitude of waveform is attracted to that thought. That thought goes around the planet in less than 7 seconds. I mean, we now think it's actually instantaneously, as we see from remote viewing and things like telepathy, that it's instantaneous. But in any event, it's a real short time, and it likely travels faster than the speed of light. So just our talking about it right now, somebody else might hear the show, and one day something will happen in their neighborhood, and they can't get out to help the kid that's, you know, fallen off his bike, but they can pray for that kid right away. And by focusing our attention on something, we know for a fact that anything we focus our attention on changes that thing. So there's really no such thing as objective research. It's all subjective with some desire for some degree of objectivity. But yeah, every scientist, no matter what they study, changes it by their consciousness.
Absolutely. Even in just a physical, you know, what some might call a real world way, they do something else to this subject. And the idea of thought, we did a show one time and I mentioned some of the studies done by, you may be familiar with Dr. Jonathan Haglund.
I don't know Jonathan's work. I've heard of him, but I don't know his work.
He did some experiments with the transcendental meditation and focusing on things, like you said, to change them. It supposedly had some success in the D.C. area for reducing crime.
Yeah, absolutely. Even cloud cover. I mean, what we know, and not to acknowledge it is to refuse the great power that Adam showed us we have, which is free will. We have a choice at all times either to emanate and elevate, that's a selfless kind of disposition and attitude, or we can try to receive and contract and be selfish. And in Kabbalah, it's basically that's what we look at. We're either emanating, you know, we're loving, we're giving, we're taking care of someone, we're feeding them, we're making their bed, we're taking the kid to school. That's a form of emanating to somebody. Or we're receiving. You know, they're giving us a note, they're giving us a hug, our grandparents call, we get a thank you from somebody. So we're always emanators and receivers. The big question that all of the elements and stories in the Hebrew Bible and the sacred societies teach us is, do we really know our intention? You know, some people will do good because they think they're going to get something from it. Maybe, you know, they'll help a boss take a kid to a ball game because they think they're going to get a promotion. So that's not really selfless service. That's kind of selfish. So it's not like you get punished for doing these things. You don't even really get punished for doing bad things, so to speak, the way people think. But it changes the frequency and the vibration of your very being, of your subtle bodies, and even of your physical body and your physical body organs. So you punish yourself. In the same way Adam punished himself, he cast himself out because he lied and then didn't take responsibility for it, so he was no longer able to receive the finer light of perfection because it would have killed him. So there's reasons for all of these realities, which is that if you're not a refined enough vessel and you're not humble and you're not loving, if that divine light came into you, you'd probably shatter. So it's all about gradations and self-refinement and ultimately coming into mastery over our emotions. And that's what my book, Sanctuary of the Divine Presence, shows, that all of these rituals and all of the different kinds of things that they did in the tabernacle actually physically changed the space. There was literally the divine presence of God, and there was literally the divine presence of divine consciousness. So unlike today, where we're in what's called the age of Yesod, the Tree of Life has these 10 spheres, and we're in the next to bottom one, like in the Hindu tradition, the time of Kali Yuga, the Dark Age, we're still coming down the elevator. And the elevator hasn't bottomed out yet, and it will in about 200 or so years, according to this prophetic calendar, at which time 1,000 years of peace begins. But between now and then is really big work for each person. So that, you know, when I think about the news, which I don't watch anymore, by the way, I used to because it was part of my business, but I don't watch network news. I don't watch any visual news anymore because most of it is so destructive to people's sensibilities, sensitivity, and loving heart. It's overwhelming how much bad stuff they flood our consciousness, our eyes, our ears, and our hearts with. And the problem with it is that it doesn't elevate, and there's so much good going on. So what I find important for everybody to know is that everything each one of us does really does change the world. So if you're watching the news and you see these terrible murders or you see horrible war, remember that as you're watching it, you're experiencing it physiologically. Your body doesn't know if it's live time or fake time, so to speak, imagined time. And on top of that, you're sort of taking away from yourself the opportunity to build other things through joy. You know, go do something for people that need something, or play music like Daniel's beautiful music, or draw, or plant gardens, or, you know, raise some honeybees. There's so much good that we can each do, and that elevates the world. So what I was trying to say, and I sort of lost my track, was when we see war and we think it's out there, them, the truth is that everything in the universe is reflecting the composite of all of us alive.
Yes, and I agree.
So when people used to scream about Saddam Hussein, I used to say on my program, has there never been a time in your life you've not acted like a tyrant or even a mini-terrorist? So that all of these things are exaggerations of personal experiences that most humans know and some have already mastered and they won't, you know, manifest. But when we watch terrorists in the world, that's a state of an inner society, not just a physical outer description.
Yes. And it's, again, an example of as within, so without.
Yes, you said it so right.
And I wanted to touch on another aspect that you did briefly go over here. And as well as mentioning, we do have our other hosts here, but right now their mics are off while I do the bulk of this interview. So I wanted Melissa and Brett just to be aware of that. I also wanted to say, back to Zoe, the idea of it can be dangerous for not properly attuned or unpure people. I've heard this of Kabbalah study as well, that there's some groups believe it's just outright dangerous. It can destroy them, as you said. Like if that light comes into an unpure person, there's an actual danger. They had a whole ritual where they would have an amulet to protect them from the angels on the ascending levels. If you could comment on that, on the danger of pursuit.
Well, I think it's an easy parallel would be if we put a six-year-old in a car and turn it on and let them go, they'll probably get killed. So it's no different when we are not mature enough to handle something. I mean, look at our scientific community. They're a good example of what has gone wrong in some respects with giving people tools to nature that they don't have the ethical maturity to use properly. So when we talk about the seriousness of earth changes, we still are detonating underground detonations in the earth and in the water that, of course, lead to tsunamis and earthquakes and plate changes. What's wrong with these people? I mean, they know there's a correlation. Maybe some don't. Maybe some can't yet see that if you hit your toe, it hurts your hand. But all of us know it. You hit your toe with your hammer and your whole body hurts. So I think in the sacred societies, it's very unlikely, firstly, that a novice is going to get hold of anything that can do them harm. When it becomes harmful is when the intention that they've been given access to certain information and the intention is a negative one, to do harm to someone else or something. And that's black magic. And it can be done very simply. I mean, just look at people killing each other. I mean, that's a form of taking a bad intent, than using a tool and using it not for self-defense or saving life, but taking life. So we see it in our mundane life all the time, but in a spiritual world, because so much of it's invisible, other than to a clairvoyant or clairsentient or clairaudient or just an intuitively sensitive person who can feel these things, we pretend that nobody knows. And so people do bad and they think nobody knows. But the whole world knows. And their own life path will prove out whatever they've done, and if not this life, next life. That's what I used to say to my kids, and they would say, you know, they'd be so angry at somebody for treating them poorly, and can't we do something about it? And I said, yeah, you know, hope that they improve their behavior, because unfortunately we all get it back. Whatever we do to the world, we do to ourselves.
That's true.
Hi, this is Kevin. Does that sort of connect to the yods or any of the yod that's in the tree?
You mean the yod, the letter yod?
Yeah, it's spelled Y-O-D, isn't that the...
Yeah, Y, uh-huh, that's the letter 10. See, the Hebrew alphabet, like many alphabets, is actually also a number system. So the first letter Aleph is 1, and the second letter Beit is 2, and Gimel is 3, and Dalet is 4, etc. So there's a big practice in Judaism, particularly in Kabbalah, and it's in my books, where you take Hebrew words, and then you reduce the words to numbers, and words with the same number value, even if they're completely different, are said to share a common spiritual root. And it's one of the ways that we can see correlations between different things. It's like a concealed method of revealing relationships between things. For instance, like when I did my study of the prophetesses, I found out that the word well in Hebrew and deliverance and other words that equaled the name of Miriam the prophetess was words in her story were also reflected in her name. So in my new book, Sanctuary of the Divine Presence, as an example, the Ark of the Holy Tabernacle and Ararat are the same number values. And Ararat is presumably where Noah's Ark came to rest. So I thought that was interesting, that two arcs, two different time periods, having two different purposes, had the same number value. So the Yud in the Tree of Life that you're looking at, there are pathways between each of the Sephirot, and the head represents our intellect, and that's three Sephirot. One is the top, that's our crown, and then the one to the right of it, like a triangle, and the left of it on the other side represent our eyes and our ears. So the top is our crown, our whole skull, and then we learn that wisdom, the first sephira coming down on the right, is wisdom, which is our eyes. And then parallel to it on the far left pillar is our ears, and these are the mother and the father. So wisdom and understanding are really what our parents are supposed to give us. And then the sixth sephira below that, all represent our emotions and are called the sun. So when Jesus or somebody else says, I am the son of God, that's true in Kabbalah, and I would say I'm a daughter of God. But we're all a daughter, a son, a mother, a father, and an ancestor, because the Tree of Life has all these different family members as well as different organ parts. So when we come down the Tree of Life, to just show you how it works, for instance, there's two sephira, one on the far right pillar, one parallel to it on the far left pillar. There are three pillars, a right, a left, and a middle. And they represent our two arms and hands. Our right hand is chesed, or loving kindness, and our left hand is gevura, which is judgment and strength. And so what it tells us is that when we do something in the world, we're supposed to be balanced by using discrimination, our judgment, have the strength to do the good that we're going to do. And it's a judgment call, like when do we give to somebody, how much do we give to them, what do we give to them? But it tells us to be in balance is to use our right and our left hand, our aptitude of loving kindness and our aptitude of judgment, discrimination, and strength. And it's balanced in the middle pillar in the torso by what's called teferet, which means truth or beauty. And so it's also telling us that beauty is balanced between love and judgment. And then we come down, and our right leg is called netzach, which is eternity. It's our will to do. And our left leg, back to what you brought up about humility, is called hod, and that is humility. So our right and our left leg get us to where we're going, and then we have to be humble. So we're already learning that we use our eyes to see wisdom, our ears to understand. We use our right hand to do loving kindness, our left hand to have strength and judgment. We balance it with beauty and truth in the middle of our heart. We then walk with the strength and endurance and humility. And then below that, coming down to the bottom of the tree, is yesod, the generative organs. And this is the age we're in. which we see in all these challenges of male and female equality or lack thereof, or who am I male or female, or can I be both, or am I transgender? These are all issues of yesod, which is ultimately a covenant. And it means that our generative organs, our sexual pleasure, our ability to co-create is a godly gift. And then finally we come to our feet, which is called malchut, and it's our kingdom or our sovereignty. And so this is a real quick run through the Tree of Life, but those are the 10 Sephirah, Daniel and Kevin and everybody else, that sit on the Tree of Life, and it's a model of us. And so when the Zohar talks about different, and I'll show you how it does it, the Zohar talks about different stories in the Hebrew Bible, they will take that story and apply it to the Tree of Life, and they will tell you which of the Sephirah it is representing. So my book, Sanctuary of the Divine Presence, shows a teaching from the Zohar that there are 10 songs in the Hebrew Bible, which are Hebrew texts, the Song of Songs of Solomon, the prayer of David after he was freed from safety from King Saul, Hannah's song of gratitude for giving birth, having conceiving Samuel, the prophetess Devorah and Barak praying, you know, for gratitude after their victory on the mountain, Tabor. There's another song of the people singing to the well. There's the song of the crossing of the Red Sea. There's the final song, by the way, is Adam just outside the Garden of Eden. So through these 10 personages in my book, Sanctuary of the Divine Presence, you can learn what a Sephirah looks like, personified by a particular heroic prophet, what they did and how they do it. And then we learn from them what that means. So King David, back to humility, I love to stay on humility, really represented this ability to serve, and that's why he was called the greatest servant of all. He wasn't allowed to build the temple because he'd been a warrior and he had blood on his hands, but God promised him that his son would bring it to fruition, who was King Solomon. So we learn from the personages these qualities, but the truth is that all of the Sephirot are operating in all of us all of the time. It's just there are times in either the generation, a century, or a personal life where one might dominate more than another.
And one of the things that I remember reading is that the purpose of, I guess, the use or union of the Sephirot is to unite male and female aspects of God, of divinity.
Yes, and absolutely.
One thing I found interesting, and I don't know if it was just me and my bad memory, but this much mention of female prophets, of prophetesses, if I can get it out.
Yeah, that's it. I wanted to call up the 7 female prophetesses, and they said, nobody can say prophetesses but you. So they called them the female prophets, which I guess is true. It'd be like a male waiter and a female waiter. I don't think so. They'd say waitress, but nonetheless, cultural aptitudes. Well, you know, I think the amazing thing about prophecy in general from the point of view of the Judaic tradition is that we're all born to be prophets. And the reason I came to that conclusion is there's a great holy book called the Sefer Yetzirah, which is the Book of Formation, probably the greatest Kabbalistic small esoteric text on the planet that I've ever seen or that I could even begin to look at. And it was presumably attributed to Abraham. And in it, it says, the end is wedged in the beginning. So I went to my Torah, the 5 books of Moses in particular, and I looked at the beginning, and the beginning is creation. And what's the end? The end is the end of Deuteronomy, where it's talking about Moses being the greatest prophet who ever was, is, or will be. And I realized, well, that must mean each of us is created to become a prophet. And what does that mean, a prophet? And there's like 13 different degrees of prophecy in Judaism that Moses Maimonides, the Rambam, outlined, and it's in my other book. It's actually in the back of this book, too, in the appendix. But it's these different stages of prophecy, and one of them is through the Holy Spirit, the Ruach HaKodesh. And that's a lower level of prophecy, but Solomon, David, all of them wrote their psalms and their songs under the influence of the Ruach HaKodesh. Then there are higher forms of prophecy where the Shekhinah, as you talked about the male and female aspects, the Ruach is like a male messenger of creator, of divinity. And the Shekhinah refers to the divine immanence or the presence of the creator. And so in the tabernacle story, that was the cloud of glory that went with the tent and filled the tent and actually changed the energy of the tent to the point that even Joshua and Moses couldn't be inside the tent when the presence came. They could only go in afterwards. So it's a or go in before it came. I mean, it's a pretty interesting. I studied it more, to be honest, as a phenomenologist because I'm not a Bible scholar. You know, I'm a researcher who turned my attention to the Hebrew Bible, but I'm a phenomenologist by practice, like many of you who do meditation and experience these altered states. So I wanted to say, well, if this really changed consciousness and brought divine revelation for all of these human beings, what does it really teach us? And that's what I go about describing in Sanctuary of the Divine Presence, is how these rituals actually bring us to an elevated state of awareness so that each of us can really help transform the world with loving, creative, intuitive solutions.
And for those people who are listening later on in the archive of this show, we've posted links to Sohara's website and other references out on our Main Street Universe group wall, just for a reference for people listening in the future.
And on air, Zoe, would you like to go ahead and plug where they can find your book, Sanctuary of the Divine Presence?
Please, yeah, you could go to my own website, www.zohara.com, and there's links right there. You can click on Sanctuary of the Divine Presence. And it's really a beautiful book. It took me 4 years to do, and I think that anybody who reads it of any faith will learn something new about self-mastery, because ultimately that's the hard work. You know, we all work in the world, and we're trying to make the world a better place, and we belong to nonprofits, and we may lead certain activities. But the bigger work is the work you also take with you when you leave your physical body behind, which is, were you able to control your emotions? Not so much not to have them, but not to react to them. You can still have anger, but what do you do when you have it? Do you wait till it passes before you speak? Do you wait till it passes before you act? Or when you feel something really, you know, lovely and intuitive about somebody, do you call them? Do you send them a prayer, a card, an email? You know, do you follow through on these hunches that you get? Because that's what all of this is about, is that divinity is always talking to us. Half the time we're too busy looking for our keys to notice. And if we just pay more attention to our dreams, our hunches, our intuitions, then all of us will be doing what we are supposed to be doing as we move towards higher levels of prophecy and higher intuition.
Yes, and I agree. And one aspect of that that I would like to get to is the idea of how in Judaism in general and in Kabbalistic Judaism is the idea of good works attuning, you know, you closer to God, and as we talked about earlier, vibrating things at a level, you know, and everything being connected and to the word of vibration, to the point of vibration, will bring me to the importance of sound and
absolutely.
Song. Because there's a song, you know, the holiest of the holies, or the 10 songs. There's Aum, you know, Aum, which is actually represents the seasons. A is spring. U is summer, M is autumn, and silence is winter. But maybe if you can comment on the importance of sound and spirituality.
When you look actually at the story of the prophets, they were always accompanied by musicians. Actually, there's two really simple ways to reach an altered state of consciousness. One is through music, and the other is through dance. And you can look at any indigenous first person's tradition, and what do they use in their ceremonies of ritual? They use drumming, music, and dance. Because these things actually get us into an elevated state of awareness, because it basically fills our awareness with something other than our chattery thoughts. When we dance, we're really absorbed in the movement and the feeling of it, and we're letting go of our intellect. And when we play music or hear music or sing music, we're also moving into a higher state of consciousness, which is not the particular rational mind as much as the higher divine mind. So music and dance both are ways to move into an ecstatic state where people literally go through a doorway in consciousness that allows you to perceive things that otherwise you might not. And it's a wonderful time when you're in one of those states to just wish well to the people around you, or to the world in general, or to the nature spirits, or to the honeybees, or something that needs our support. And so it's extremely important. What's unfortunate is that so much art, and I want to speak of art for a moment, and music in particular, is therapeutic for the musician, but it's pretty destructive for the listener. You know, it's antagonistic, it's disharmonic, and that actually breaks down the field of any listener. So it's important. You know, there was a great study done on what plants grow best, and what they found was, and there was great work done by Dan Carlson of Sonic Bloom, as well as others, that the music of Mozart opened up the stomata of the plant, and it could take in greater sugar and grew more. So they started doing this out in the large orchards of playing the music, which was a certain frequency. And what was its frequency? That of the songbird. So when songbirds come and sing, they actually help plants grow. So all of these things in nature, the more we can observe nature, the more we can really understand the spiritual traditions, because that's how it's all connected. It's all the same teaching, whether it's in nature or ourselves.
Yes, and one, a lot of people, when they think of Judaism, they might not think of a mantra meditation. I remember a mantra, if I'm saying this right, it was something like Ribbono Shel Olam.
Shalom? Ribbono Shalom?
Master
of the
universe.
In Judaism, they can take any word, and you can focus on it and meditate on it. I mean, it used to be, I think within the ancient Kabbalistic schools, meditation was much more practiced than it is today, because I think it became associated with the Eastern tradition and, you know, these kinds of silly things that separate people from the great bowl of wisdom because of cultural framework. So meditation has returned, fortunately, and you can literally, and you can do this in your own life, just take a statement for the day. I will bless the trees. That becomes your mantra for that day. And I promise you it will change the way you look at every tree you drive by. I will bless the trees. Or you wake up one day and you say, I will pick up litter. You go to the grocery store and you do it. I mean, these are the reason to have a mantra, an affirmation, an intention, is that it gives our consciousness a focus that can be made holy. By bringing our intention to something and then consecrating it, in my book, Sanctuary of the Divine Presence, it shows that there's actually five stages we go through in the initiatic process. The first is actually in Judaism called initiation, and what it is to pray. Prayer is the foundation of the initiatic path in Judaism, and in most traditions you can call it meditation, prayer meditation. The second is consecration, meaning we consecrate our limbs, we consecrate our will and what we do to elevating everything we touch. When we make food, we stay right focused. When we make our beds, we don't do it with anger. No matter what we do, we try to bring our highest feeling awareness to it, and that's consecration. We're consecrating everything we do with holy intent. And after consecration comes elevation. And elevation is when we actually have the ability to bring this more refined behavior to everybody we're around. We elevate everything we touch and everybody we see and everything we do. And after elevation comes illumination, where, and these are stages actually in the tabernacle, by the way. The initiation is outside the tabernacle where everybody prays. The consecration are the fire rituals, the water rituals that they do in the outer court. The elevation happens inside what's called the holies in the tabernacle, and this is where the priest kept the candelabra burning day and night, 24 hours a day with oil, seven lamps, and also the holy incense that they burned, and the shewbread that were brought there before Sabbath every week. And so these represent the faculties of our soul, the seven holy holes of our head, our eyes, our ears, our mouth, our nose, even our sense of touch. And this is when we reach elevation, meaning we can elevate everything through our senses. Our senses are phenomenal faculties of the soul. That's why I have clairsentience, clairaudience, all those kinds of things. And then when we reach the Holy of Holies, which is where the Ark is and where the holy cherubim sit and where the Hebrew Torah is put and the bottle of manna, the jar of manna, and presumably Aaron's staff and maybe even Moses' staff are there, we reach a point of illumination and then revelation. Because inside the Holy of Holies, where the high priest went one time a year on the Day of Atonement, the Day of Yom Kippur, to really bring the entire community into right behavior, right thoughtfulness through an act of massive asking of forgiveness, a massive act of humility, we reach divine revelation. And then we each receive basically our instructions for our own life, for our own conduct. So the stages of the tabernacle tradition and the priests are stages we go through. Again, it's initiation, then consecration, then elevation, then illumination, and finally revelation. So those stages are depicted in the book, as well as being the stages in different aspects of our own soul development, because in Kabbalah, the soul has five parts, and those are analogous to those things of initiation, consecration, elevation, illumination, and revelation. It's very particular. Like every tradition, there is a method that the Hebrew tabernacle tradition leaves us, and that's what I've been able to decipher and to give over.
And again, the number five comes up, which is very important number in many mystical traditions, five being...
Well, for sure. I mean, you know, you can take any number and it's holy. They just represent different archetypes. And five, we have five digits on each hand, which brings us to 10, and we have five digits on each foot, and that brings us to 10. And 10 in Kabbalah, like the 10 Sephirah, is very important. You know, there were supposedly 10 things that made creation, and they call those the Sephirot themselves. There are different 10 qualities of the prophet, 10 different types of song. So 10 becomes very important. It's sort of like a cosmogenesis of Judaism is in the tens, but it's made of two fives, which is made of, you know, 10 olives. So you can go, that's the number one or the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet.
Yes, and whenever I do tarot, I'm big into the numerology side of a reading. I always go right to it. It's just something that I've always naturally, when I was learning, that's where I naturally went to. It just felt extremely natural to me. And I'd like to go...
Well, you know, I'd like to say that's a good meditation. I had my teacher, Mr. Avital, who I mentioned earlier, who I met when I was 19, and about, I guess, 15 years ago, he had me do an exercise, or about that, maybe sooner, for 22 days I would meditate on each of the Hebrew letters. And so it took me a year and a half to do the alphabet, basically, because all I did was just look at it and meditate on it and write down what I saw. And that's how I learned Hebrew, was through each letter, because the letters aren't really just two-dimensional graphic signs. They're literally multidimensional beings that have power. So all of alchemy and all of when we write talismans or you make incantations in Hebrew, it's based on the power of each letter. For instance, you know, Aleph is the air and Sheen is the fire and Mem is the water. And so they would be able to combine letters in such a way to actually use the elements of air, fire, water, earth to create certain phenomena or to stop certain phenomena, like Joshua, who represents Gevura, our sword of discrimination, was able to stop with God's help the sun and the moon, and it stood still for 36 hours. So it was another demonstration of all this phenomena that exists in so many traditions and in science fiction. I wanted to find out, well, where was it in the Hebrew Bible, if it was?
And it is interesting, and it's interesting how the history, you know, evolved and stopped. There was one story I remember reading on Kabbalah where they mentioned Shabbatai Tzvi, if I'm saying that name right.
Shabbatai Tzvi.
And had he not converted to, he was a Kabbalist of his time, had he not converted, he was sort of forced to convert to Islam, he might have been seen as some sort of Messiah. You know, he was getting a large following. And so here then the history of this mystery tradition sort of took a kind of a beating there, I guess.
Well, I think that's true, and even you could say in some ways with the Madonna pop Kabbalah, it hurt the tradition. But I think everything has its time and age, and this is the age prophesied for thousands of years by the Jewish people that Kabbalah is meant to be given over to the whole world. And the reason for it is that it's really a scientific and philosophic management system for anything, whether it's ourselves or technology. And so it's a beautiful tradition, but it's not a weekend workshop. You know, just like refining ourselves doesn't happen because we had one peak experience at one fantastic sweat lodge. You know, that was a great experience then, and then we go home and we go back to work, and how do we conduct ourselves? Are we different kinds of people? Do we improve the way we think about others or treat them or even ourselves? So all of this work is a gradual unfoldment of the human becoming. It's never an accomplishment. You know, you won't generally meet any great master of any tradition who goes around with a banner or an advertisement or charging money for their teachings. The great ones aren't present in that way. They just go about their life, and most of them, it could be a milkman in the old days. You know, it could be a taxi driver. It could be one of the holiest saints on the planet. And they go about doing their lives and teaching the people that are ready for the teaching, but I can promise you they're not going to, like, charge you money. Because what they're looking for are vessels that are able to hold the light and hold the teachings and pass it on to others. And in the historic way of the Western mystery tradition, anyway, it was forbidden to charge people for teachings. I mean, maybe they could do something else for you, you know, maybe they could clean your floor or make your food, but it would be a trade, but it wasn't a living because it's holy work. And so it's not a utility for, you know, public promotion in that way. But we live in the age of information, so people confuse the hard spiritual path with information. There's plenty of information. You can get information from every website on earth now about every tradition, but that's not the path. That's information about it. Doing it is the hard work of being mindful of how you conduct yourself, being mindful of how we do things, being mindful of the kind of energy we give off, being mindful of whether we've taken care of someone who needed help or did we ignore them. I mean, this is the path. The path is of service. You know, the path is of compassion. The path is attentive mindfulness. And the rest is information. So I think that sometimes people make a mistake of taking a few workshops and then calling themselves something. Oh, I'm a shaman now, you know. Oh, I took a workshop with the shaman and now I'm a shaman. Well, the truth is a shaman, most of them, some are teaching publicly because it's time for the elder wisdom to come over to the whole world. But at the same time, we aren't these things. We are still, I'm still Zohara and you're still Daniel, and I do these things. But it's really about a slow mastery of the self, and then you have no reason to name what it is you are or do. You just do it. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. And one thing I wanted to comment about that is the idea that I always, and I say this on the show all the time, I don't come across like I'm your expert. I come across, I say I'm an explorer. I'm an explorer.
Exactly.
I'm a student. And believe me, my growth is gradual, as you mentioned.
Yeah,
sometimes more gradual than others.
Yeah,
like
we have slow
this
years
weekend.
And off years, and then we have peak moments, and God bless both.
Yes.
Come more often and just be my steady stream.
It's a daily thing. I mean, the first to admit I'm extremely flawed as a human being in a lot of ways, and we all have things to work on.
Well, we wouldn't incarnate. If we didn't have important work to do, we wouldn't incarnate. I mean, in the Kabbalah, as this book shows, resurrection is very much a teaching in Judaism, but many Jews don't know that, and most of the world doesn't. But it is. It's a deep part of traditional Judaism, as is the notion that we are designed to have an immortal body and an immortal soul. So we're still sort of dealing with this flesh at the level we manage to hang on to it, if we're lucky, up to 120 years, the age of Abraham. But presumably, Adam was designed to have 1,000 or more years of life, and he took some off to give it to David so that his life could be longer. That's one of the oral teachings. But this notion of multidimensionality, which Kabbalah really is a 10-dimensional universe, like the great physicist Bill Tiller describes, is a description of not just a physical form, but an immortal form that can be sustained through intention. You know how we see in sci-fi films or people who claim in UFOs materialization, like in Star Trek, and dematerialization?
Mm-hmm.
Presumably that also is our birthright, and we have that capacity from long ago, and one day we'll have that again. And in Judaism it says after these 1,000 years of peace, beginning in about 230 years, though the possibility is always present today, there will be no life on earth for another 1,000 years. So like the Brahmin traditions, the Hindu tradition, there's some far-out prophecies about life on earth and then no life on earth, and then life comes back to earth and then no life. So it's showing that our consciousness is the greatest immortal aspect of ourselves, and that consciousness is the field of the whole ball of wax. Consciousness is the cosmos. So that's why it becomes so important that we get a handle on ourselves, because every thought and every instinct and every sort of move affects the field of consciousness of all consciousness, not just ours, but alien consciousness and the consciousness on Mars and the consciousness in the solar system. And I know people think, oh, that sounds so far out and ridiculous, but it's physically true once you accept that everything is connected in the immaterial domain, which I believe it is, and that's actually what the ancient Hebrews taught us as well.
Yes, and I agree. And even scientists, when they win a Nobel Prize, some of these physicists, they'll say things like, hey, but leave room for wonder. Some of the scientific people I know in my real life that are really mathematicians, they will say, because they work with it. They work with it, and they go, look, I'm still figuring stuff out here. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But they still believe that there's some mystery. They might not spend as much time with it as I do, but they still believe, hey, leave room for wonder.
Oh, absolutely. And that was that fear you talked about, Yira. It's also awe. It's love and awe. It's not a fear of, oh, I'm going to be punished like a child. It's not infantilism. It's a mature respect. It's reverence. You know, reverence is really the solution, as far as I see, to the future. You know, anytime anybody asks a question, ask, is the solution a reverent one? You know, if the new technology will really elevate and serve, is it reverent? Then it's a good technology. If it's a technology like crowd control that literally destroys people's frame of mind so that they get depressed or agitated or angry or can't move, you know, that's not good. I understand why governments do it, but that's not good. So that's sort of the barometer I use now, is I use reverence as the solution. And I look at anything I hear, whether it's a politician or a scientist or a friend saying something, I think to myself, well, is that a reverent solution? Meaning, does it elevate all parts? Does it elevate the worker? Does it elevate the materials? Does it elevate nature? Does it elevate humans who use it? So I think that the answers are really simple. The journey, though, is one of choosing what's best for everyone, or as many as possible, or to do as little harm, you know, to walk softly.
Mm-hmm. And I agree. And I want to take a brief time out here, Zoe, just to do a couple plugs, and then we'll get back. And we've been talking for, gosh, how long has it been now?
About an hour.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time you've given me to share these beautiful teachings.
Sure, it's great, and you've been an amazing guest. Just going to do a couple plugs here, and then we'll bring Melissa on, too. She's been waiting in the queue after these plugs. First, I'd like to start out with Lily, who's been on our show. She has a store called Esoterica. It used to be brick and mortar. Now it is online only. www.esotericanova.com, 703-777-4642. Still with the New Age interface, focus, herbs, crystal stones, oils, candles, incense, divination tools, and more is www.esotericanova.com. Kevin Baird, my co-host here, psychic medium, intuitive consultant. You can be reached at www.templeofgaia.com, or you can experience him live in person at the stores Crystalis in Herndon or Sticks and Stones in Fairfax.
Or here on the show on broadcast day.
Yes, and you can call in or chat room and ask for a reading.
Right.
He is the inventor of the Horizon Oracle deck. He doesn't read the traditional tarot anymore. He created his own divination language through the Horizon Oracle deck. Okay, and Melissa, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Curious if you had any questions or inquiries for...
I do, actually. I have several. One of the things that really intrigued me with your work is the theme of the midwife. This is something you referred to Miriam as, but in your latest book, you describe humanity as the midwives of the messianic age, basically where we're ushering it in like it's a newborn. And I was wondering if you could speak a little more about the archetypical role of the midwife.
Sure, and I believe that's true. They say we're experiencing the pangs of Mashiach, that we actually are, as you point out and as my book talks about. The midwife falls in this instance under the Sephira of Gevurah. And Gevurah, again, if we would think about our life as concealed good and revealed good is when we're happy, our jobs are good, our marriages are good, things are great. concealed good is when we are sick, we lost our job. God forbid we lose somebody we love. So that's the left hand. Gevura is like the concealed good. So when we think about a child being born, it's still within the womb of the mother. It's concealed good. We know the child is in there. We know the child is trying to come out. And we do everything we can to make the mother comfortable, to facilitate. Well, we should. I don't think the medical model does much in that way at all, having her lie on her back, but and as I had to as well. But as a concept of giving, of midwifing something, is we are caring for somebody or something, being the earth, other than just ourselves. When we midwife, a midwife is an attendant to the person giving birth. So Miriam, as an example, in the first book, was the midwife of the Jewish people. She literally brought them through the Red Sea with Moses when they get to the other side and the waters are held back. It was Miriam who led the women and her brother Moses who led the men. And Miriam physically was a midwife throughout their journey, as she was when she basically, as a young child, prophesied the birth of Moses. And so she basically midwifed the Jewish people into a new state of consciousness and a new land. We, being in the age of Yesod, the generative organs, the womb, as well as the phallus, are giving birth to a new stage of consciousness and to a beautiful world unity. Unity consciousness is really the direction that we're all moving. And I think any one of us can imagine what that will feel like when we think about, if you've been blessed enough to have given birth or been present at a birth, whether it's not a human, maybe a puppy or a kitten or something, that feeling of awe, joy, and love that overtakes you completely. So that's really, that's what we are midwifing, that state of unity, consciousness, joy, and love that we experience when we midwife a woman giving birth or an animal giving birth. Does that explain it well?
Very well, thank you.
I'm glad you understood those two connections.
I also wanted to bring up a point you made. You talked about it a little bit earlier about our prophecy being our natural divine inheritance and our natural state of being. And I was wondering if what we today can do to awaken that natural state.
I think the most important thing is just practice, meaning practice following your instincts and your intuitions. If you have a dream about somebody, you know, follow up on it. If you have a thought to get off the highway at a certain exit and it just seems strange, why should you? Do it anyway and see what happens. There's some simple exercises we can do, and Kevin certainly knows as a psychic that we can strengthen these organs of telepathy, of intuition, of being able to hear that which is not yet physical but coming into form, which is really what we're reading when we're reading on other planes. So there's simple exercises. When you drive, if you're on backcountry roads, try to see in your mind's eye what the color of the next car is coming. I know it sounds silly. When you go out to eat, don't add up the check in your mind rationally. Try to picture the number that shows up. Have a friend take three objects, put one in each in a different brown bag, and then look at it, and hidden from view, obviously, and draw the shape that you see. What I'm talking about is prophecy is a form of intuition, and the way to strengthen intuition is to practice using it. And the way to practice using it is you can do little exercises. You can do it with a friend. Let's say you have a girlfriend or a boyfriend or your spouse is traveling. Ask your spouse to put something on the night table and not tell you what it is. Don't try to name it. Ingo Swann and all these great remote viewers who did the work with the government early in the 60s, who I've worked with for years, said the problem is rationally we try to name and describe what we're looking at rather than just practice drawing the shape, getting a feeling for it, because our soul has the capacity to feel these things. It's the rational mind that gets impatient. So if you can push the rational mind a little bit out of the picture and try to focus on your feeling and your intuition, which is sort of a higher mind blackboard, that's how I think of it, we can develop this capacity, because prophecy literally means to see the future, to avert natural disaster, to bring people back to unity, back to God. So this is what we're all here to do, and that's why, again, this work of self-refinement, self-mastery absolutely leads to it. I mean, it can't not work. So if somebody really does this work of refining themselves and controlling their anger and using goodwill and doing good works, you will develop these skills even if you're not doing these kinds of practices, because that part of yourself will open up because it's a vibration that's more refined. But you can do these other things to practice.
This is Kevin. I have an exercise that I give people where I tell them when they're stressing about something and they see a yellow Volkswagen Beetle go by, that the universe is telling them to not worry about it and that they have it under control and it's time to move on to think about something else.
That's great. I'm going to have to look around for a yellow Volkswagen
Beetle. Yellow Volkswagen Beetle. I had a client once say, I didn't see a yellow bug for like 3 weeks, and she was thinking about calling me, and she was watching TV while she's thinking about it. And right then and there, a Volkswagen commercial came on, and there were 30 yellow Volkswagen Beetles flying around
riot.
On the screen as part of the advertising.
That's so funny. But you've just proven a point, that if you give meaning to something and then you pay attention, it has that impact. But to somebody who has attached no meaning to the yellow bug, it's not going to mean anything. So,
exactly.
And that's why when you make your own deck, of course it works, because it just allows our consciousness to filter through a system of symbols.
Yes.
Yeah, great. Or as I say, if you see a black crow, there's a speed trap. That's been my experience.
Yeah. And they're thriving right now.
Yes, they are.
I had one throw an apple at me a little while back.
Oh, my.
I had a bone tossed at me by one.
And Melissa, any more questions?
Just one last one from, this one is again from the Kabbalistic teachings of the female prophets. You wrote in Sarah's story, when society inhibits the freedom of women or their intuitive natures, and you'll forgive my pronunciation on this, the Sheshchina, and therefore prophecy is also suppressed.
Absolutely.
And are there other exercises you would recommend for women who have been cut off from their intuitive nature?
Well, I think the nature of woman, just the faculty of the divine feminine, is inclusivity. And because so many of us have gone to work in the world, and we work with men, and we work sometimes in a male profession, historically speaking, as I did in radio, you sometimes can take on attributes that would not be necessarily the way you'd develop if you were just around women. So we're at a really interesting time in history for men and women, because one life we might be male, and the next life we might be female, and in every life we're both. It's just as female, we're 49% female and 48%. Did I do my math right? No, I didn't do my math right. 51% female, there we go. So that I think for women, the project is really to work at inclusivity. It really is for every human. But if you're talking about the natural nature of a woman is to include, not to exclude. And so when I look at things like the prophetess Deborah was the prophetess that was the judge of Israel. Not only she was the only female judge, but she was the only judge that was actually allowed to sentence people. So why a woman? Because they felt that a woman has more mercy. So I'd say for women, it's women automatically have higher intuition in general than men. But intuitive men actually, like Kevin and Daniel, work at it and cultivate it. So for a woman to just cultivate her natural ability to love and to care and to be empathic is really important, because nature herself needs us. You know, even if we still have to fight for equal pay and equal, you know, acceptance in different domains in culture is not as significant, in my opinion right now, as sustaining the earth. So I think for women and any woman listening, to do something for the earth is where our work is so important, because I keep mentioning the honeybee. We have lost almost 70 to 80% of our honeybee population. If this continues, we will decidedly have famine, because 70% of our crops are pollinated. Einstein even recognized this and said it, I think, back in the 50s. I'm not sure under what condition he said it, but he said if we lose the honeybees, we lose our food. So the earth herself needs our help. So I'd say to every woman listening, do a garden, do something, plant some flowers that attract bees, work at the soup kitchen, do anything, or an environmental group, anything that can support the earth in your own life, recycling, you know, don't drink bottled water, be sure the water's good in your community. Take care of the earth. I think that would be, nobody's ever really asked me that. So it's not really personal in that way, but it's personal in the sense of how each person might express it. So I'd say take care of the earth.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the questions. They're all wonderful.
And you have a very good question. And Melissa's our new addition here, and I think she's a great addition thus far.
Wonderful. Well, women think about things differently. You know, when I was a full-time broadcaster covering world affairs and international events and local stuff as well, I found the questions I asked were different than men in general as a broadcaster, and the business was filled with men. I was one of the only women in the whole country that was covering the World Bank and the IMF and then jumping into near-death experience or something. But I learned, you know, there's a funny little story. I was a lucid dreamer, and I would use my dreams for everything, which I still do. It's always been an important part of my life. And I dreamt about Stinger missiles being for sale in Zagreb, Croatia. And I was shown a map in my dream, and the next day I went on the air, and whatever I see comes out of my mouth. I don't know why. I got called after the show by federal government employees. I don't need to say which branch, but I was interrogated for who was feeding me information.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, it's interesting how, and that was how I did a lot of current event stories, is I got intuitive hunches. When I covered the murders at Waco, I had lots of intuitive hunches and found witnesses. And so I've always used my intuition in my careers. Even when I set up the Holistic Health Center, I founded the oldest holistic healing center in America, which I founded in 1984 here in Baltimore, called the Ruscomb Mansion. And that also was the result of intuition. I had a vision of what a healing center could look like, but, you know, I had no reason to do it other than this vision. So I think following your visions are lead for a really interesting life, and you learn a lot about yourself and which visions are imagination or projection and which are your higher self really speaking loudly.
Yes. And one thing, when you're talking about the differences between women and men, I'm reminded of a joke. I believe it was Robin Williams that said, yes, if women were in charge of everything, there'd be less war and less death, but once a month would be really intense negotiations.
That's
but
true.
Less actual war.
Until you hit menopause, and then you just want to destroy the women. You know, when you think about the destruction of all the women in the Middle Ages, they went after the crones first, because I can vouch for it. Menopause changes a woman. You know, until menopause, a woman is, well, I don't know, you know, what do you think? Or, do you want that? I'm not sure if I do. Once menopause hits, it's like, it doesn't matter, we're doing this. You know, boundaries become really easy for women in menopause, and your intuition is even greater. And so when you think of the elder women of natural societies around the world, they're revered, and they're the great-grandmother teachers. But in our culture, instead you have women in the West running to get surgery, trying to take pills that'll change their natural state of being. They swing through menopause without experiencing the spiritual kick that it is by taking drugs that take away all the symptoms. That's the other thing is, I mean, menopause is a spiritual doorway, and I encourage as many women as possible to walk through it naturally because it will change you for the better.
Well, there's a lot of intuitive people out there who medicate to keep their voices silented.
We have a drug nation. You know, they say just say no to drugs, but they say no to the ones that are mind expanding and yes to the ones that are mind denuding. Yeah. So all these kids on Ritalin, I've said for years, we're destroying our geniuses.
True.
Yep, and it causes them to have to carry backpacks at 5 years old.
Oh, the whole thing is just shameful.
And for a very, very, very brief time as a kid, I was, my mom, because I was hyperactive, had me on one of those substances, but it was for a very short time. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was long enough to do any damage. I think I'm fine anyway. But,
well, I definitely, if I had been born in this day and age, I would have been a drug candidate for certain, because I was hyperactive and I was always restless and always ready for the next thing. And that's what they don't like in schools, because they don't like children that are bored by boring substance and boring content and boring methodology. And whatever happened to free play and creative imagination? You know, Joseph Chilton Pierce, who's written numbers of books, including Biology of Transcendence and Cracking the Cosmic Egg, is quick to point out that imaginative play is so essential for the development of a sovereign being. And if you look at our culture is doing everything it can to destroy the notion that a sovereign soul has any rights as a sovereign individual to have creative imagination and to work outside the box and to push outside the factory line kind of thinking. So it's very frightening to me to think how many of our children, you know, 1 out of 10, if not more now, are on some form of psychotic-producing drug. And all of those killers, when I was on radio, the Columbine and others, they were all on these kinds of depressant, antidepressant drugs that lead to mania. And there wasn't one that wasn't.
At the same time, and this is somebody speaking from experience, in our culture, we talk a lot about early diagnosis for things like autism, but we have a lot of stigma on other learning disabilities that do affect kids, such as attention deficit disorder. And we don't, while there is a tendency to over-medicate for them, and there can be side effects to those medicines, there is certainly a need to pay attention and accommodate those disabilities, just as accommodate some of the others that don't have stigma.
I mean, what they call a disability is just a new clinical addition to the drug factory. So I'm not so sure attention deficit disorder is quote-unquote what they say it is, and it could also be linked to vaccines and the kind of inflammation of the brain that takes place when they pump all of these viruses into a baby body on the same day. I mean, it's idiotic. In Japan, they don't vaccinate until child is 2. At least it used to be that way. And only in this country are we stuffing these vaccines or flu shots into our eldest population and our youngest population. And the truth is, there is no research to prove what any of these combinations do to a single person.
I have a master teacher who says that people who are born with autism or dyslexia or something are born with an open channel, and that if we were the minority and the people with autism or Down syndrome were the primary humans on the planet, then we would be the ones that would be handicapped.
This is true. I've also done a lot of reading that says that people with these so-called learning disabilities, you know, 1,000 years ago would have been the shamans among their people because of their difference in perception, the difference in the way that they feel and understand things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, you know, you all are making really interesting points, is that we have a culture that's quick to drug. That's why I'm so offended by the drug war, that we now have 1 out of 10 people in prison, I mean 1 out of 100 people in prison in this country. And most of it's for offenses that never injured another person or their property. And then on top of it, it's indentured servitude because they have to make things and they don't get paid for them. And it's the new slave plantation. And nobody talks about these things. So it's I think, you know, the interesting thing about our culture is that the media focuses our attention. I don't mean to say that it's all conspiratorial, but it's a mindset. It's a way of seeing the world, feeling the world, and thinking the world. And they all seem to feel and think at the same, which is very mechanistic, that there's only the physical thing, and there's nothing spiritual, and there's no formative forces, and there's nothing etheric, and there's no vital force. So I think until quantum physics maybe gets a little bit more into the mainstream to show all these realities that the spiritual traditions have talked about, we're still going to have to buck the really coarser material world that says all there is the physical atom.
Yes, and you're mentioning, I've mentioned on the show before that the United States of America incarcerates more people than any country that has ever existed on the planet Earth. And I don't want to get too deep into that, but I want to take it to your point of the fear-based media. We've talked about that on the show too, how these shows are designed to have you be afraid of your neighbor. Instead of to have you, there's so many of these shows out there. They're criminal shows with like the guy doing just like the most awful things to people, and it's all focused on this bad guy that's in your neighborhood that could be doing this thing. Instead of focusing on think outside the box,
we actually have less violence and less war than we ever had, but you'd never know it by looking at our common culture. And Hollywood is the biggest culprit of all. You know, what if Hollywood all of a sudden made 1,000 what the bleep do you know kinds of films? Rather than the chase and kill and destroy. I mean, I've really never understood it, like an Angelina Jolie as an example, who can, you know, go all do this wonderful work for the world and then go create films where all you're doing is killing.
Yeah.
So our culture does this. We do it in animal research, you know. We say we love animals, and then we experiment and torture them. So we have a terrible habit as human beings of being able, it's a very schizophrenic kind of thing, of being able to disassociate ourselves from the things we do as a culture.
Yes, and I agree that it's not necessarily always conspiracy. It just becomes, it becomes the wave, it becomes the vibration that, that just continues to grow within
mm-hmm.
itself. So
it's
the people involved
quo.
In it.
Yeah, and I think if it makes money, it stays, and if it loses money, it goes. So, unfortunately, that's what I call death economy. I mean, I kind of simplified all of this after my years and years of covering the world into to a simple model of we need a life economy, and I hope you all take this and use it. A death economy is what we have. You know, it's war. We have a war on the land, a war on the body, a war on women, a war on our health. Otherwise, we wouldn't have the kind of health care we have, which is disease maintenance, it's not preventative health, et cetera. If we had a life economy, think how different the questions are that we'd ask. We'd ask, what sustains a life the longest? Having meaning, having good food, having organic soil. You know, we'd be asking different questions. We certainly wouldn't be thinking as war as a method for solving anything. We'd think, how can we develop the economy of this location on the planet so they, the people themselves, would be intolerant of a military dictator? Rather than let's go in and arm both sides and start a war against the middle and see who comes out on top, which is really what we've done around the world as a nation, unfortunately. That's a little karmic reality we're going to have to pay. But I think that a life economy, if you think of that word versus a death economy, which we currently have, what would the nightly news look like? If we had a life economy, don't you think they'd be showing life-affirming, wonderful things people can do and are doing, rather than the latest hijacking, kidnapping, or murder? So I think it's really simple, actually, as a way to describe the shift, is to move from a death economy to a life economy.
Well, I think the shift is going because cable is about to die, and that media on the web, media on the web is going to be picked up to where people are watching the content that they want to watch and ignoring what the broadcasters are trying to shove down our eyes and our ears.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to comment, Zoe, that I might owe you like $5 because on my show here, I have used the word life economy before.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that because, you know, I've been talking about it for about 15 years and I have a third book coming out next year with Inner Traditions and I mention it. And I think it's a great thing and I really hope it becomes a very popular slogan, you know, maybe some of the younger folks listening will do it. Let's have a life economy. It's all the Occupy Wall Streeters, wherever they sleep, could or stand, hold up a sign. We need a life economy.
And for people who are listening to the archive of the show, you can find links to Zohara on our Facebook Main Street Universe group wall. We have links about the topics that were talked about today and things from the past as well.
Okay. And we are coming close to a wind down here. I would like for Zohara and then Melissa, and any closing statements on Sanctuary of the Divine?
Well, I just want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to share some of my own experience in my writing, Sanctuary of the Divine Presence, and it can be found at Zohara, Z-O-H-A-A-R-A online.com, ZoharaOnline.com, and to thank what you all are doing, because I think the more of these kinds of programs where people have an opportunity to express their own insight, practice, and life experience, everybody will know that their life experience is important and that there's nobody like each person that exists. So each of us has a reason for being here, and it's an important reason, and our presence, our actually being here, is the greatest gift we bring. So refine our presence so wherever we go, we make holy.
Beautifully said, and you're very welcome to be here. I'm very glad that you were here. And Melissa, any closing statements?
I think she about summed this up, but yeah.
All right, very well then. And I would like to say, Zoe, that I will practice very hard to say prophetesses.
There you go, prophetesses.
It's not so hard to say a female prophet after all, is it? Prophetesses, there we go. Spit it right out
right.
That time.
Right.
And thank you, Kevin Baird, for being here today.
Thank you, thank you.
And next week, folks, we are going to be doing our spring ritual, right? That's our Mayday, Beltane, and
celebrating the Maypole.
all of that. I don't know if we'll actually have one in the studio, but that would be a little bit tricky. Anyway, everybody, thank you again. Yes. And remember that the mysteries and possibilities of the universe are closer to Main Street than you may have ever imagined. Thank you all, and blessed be.